Hey, this is Esben. I play drums in Monolord. We're on tour now supporting our new album, No Comfort, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Well, all right. Hey, everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. As you've heard, we are welcoming special guest Esben Willems of the kick-ass band Monolord, a band that brings their doom stoner heavy rock sound and embeds it deep onto heaps of varied special vinyl pressings. They have colored pressings and splatter one-offs and heaps more. And right now, Monolord is celebrating their new album, No Comfort, on Relapse Records, and they are currently touring the planet with North American tour dates all throughout November 2019. So if you are driving distance from either San Diego, Tucson, Albuquerque, Dallas, Austin, Lafayette, New Orleans, Atlanta, Asheville, Richmond, Baltimore, Philly, Brooklyn, Chicago, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Lawrence, Denver, or Los Angeles, head over to facebook.com/monolordsweden to check out ticket links and pick up their records at monolord.bandcamp.com. And hey, I'm not going to tell anyone your secret. I know you are a really nice person, and because you are, you likely have a Christmas list with some record fiends on that, and you're looking for a gift for them. So, along with that new Monolord LP you're getting them, make sure to pick up a Groove Washer record cleaning kit. They're great Christmas gifts. Every record maniac needs one. I use the Groove Washer every day, sometimes multiple times a day, and it helps my records look and sound their very best. And by the way, I also keep a small bottle of the Groove Washer record cleaner in my pocket when I go to record shows, because it helps me figure out which marks on the records are hair or dust or mold, and which marks are truly scratches and records I should avoid. And right now, if you get a Groove Washer record cleaner, I'm going to give you 10% off with a special promo code. Use VinylGuide10 at checkout, and you'll get 10% off your full order at groovewasher.com. By the way, they ship worldwide, so no matter where you're at, you can get a Groove Washer, the very best manual record cleaning system on the planet. Go to groovewasher.com, 10% off with checkout code VinylGuide10. And before we start today's interview, I gotta tell you about a few events we have coming up. The Vinyl Guide is going on the road. Yep, your buddy Nate is going to be interviewing people in front of live audiences. Starting Saturday, November 9th, the Vinyl Guide Live podcast at Australian Music Week in Cronulla near Sydney. My guest will be industry commentator Bob Lefsetz. If you read the Lefsetz letter, you know who I'm talking about. It's going to be an amazing show, amazing conversation. Google Australian Music Week for details and links. I also have it at facebook.com/vinylguide. And also, if you're in Southern California, mark your calendars. Saturday, November 23rd, the Vinyl Guide Live podcast at Cream Tangerine Records in Costa Mesa, California. We're coming back. This time we are featuring a live interview and audience Q&A with none other than Zappa Vaultmeister, Joe Travers. We're going to be talking Zappa and vinyl and recordings and rare stuff. He'll be taking audience questions. It is going to be a friggin' blast. Seating is way limited, so get your pass early at Cream Tangerine Records. You can go there right now. Get your pass quickly. These will not last long. More information on these events and more at facebook.com/vinylguide. And with that, let's start our chit-chat with Esben Willems of Monolord.
Hello.
Hello, is this Esben?
This is Esben. Hello, yeah. Nate.
How are you today?
I'm fine, I think. I just woke up. We're in Cologne today. Oh. I'm touring, I have the obligatory tour cold. That's nice.
and you're just starting off on this tour. You've got a couple of months ahead of you. You better get some vitamin C, man.
Yeah, I know.
How is it on tour? Are you guys hard on your bodies on tour? Are you a bit rough? Partying, or you take care of yourself?
Yeah, we are rough on ourselves, but not the way you might think. Mm-hmm. It's more about lack of sleep, bad food, no food, too much food, then no sleep again, and everything's upside down. So yeah,
annoying interviews. all that stuff.
Oh no, that's the relaxing part. That's nice.
Hey, let me ask you this. Now, I know you're touring Europe right now. You're getting ready to also come over to the States for just about all the month of November, and your dates of your tour are like there's no rest. You guys have almost no daylight between your live dates. How do you stay healthy? How do you cope even mentally, not let alone physically, with all that?
I think we don't, but it's been like that from the start, more or less, because we wanna play. When we tour, we wanna play as much as possible. It's like days off. It's mostly expensive, and you end up somewhere where nothing happens, like some sleepy town on a rainy Sunday. So you could might as well play a show because that's fun. Mm-hmm. And we still do that. I think it's time to get a little more days off in between, maybe. But I mean, it's a bit complex. It's rough playing every day, but at the same time, it's really rough to have a day off. And the first show after one day off is like, then you've lost your momentum. And you got to get back into it. It's really fun. I love it. Being on stage is the best.
Right.
But when you're in the momentum, it feels like a marathon.
Yeah.
It feels better to keep running, if that makes sense.
Well, you know,
at least it does to me.
I used to train for cycling. I used to cycle a lot. And I would always find that I would go really well for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then I would take a week off. And getting back on it was so hard. But then you bounce back higher. And you're able to do much more physically anyway. Do you guys have a kind of a rhythm to your touring like that? Or is it just kind of best effort at this point?
That's actually the perfect comparison. I mean, I think 3 weeks, that's the magic length of a tour to me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think for all of us, it's 3 weeks is perfect because then you can play every day and you have the energy to do it full on for the entire 3 weeks. But if you get about 1 week or 2 weeks off in between, then you can do another 3 weeks the same way. But doing 6 weeks in a row, which we've done, that's tough. When you get to week four, week five, that's, you're on your knees.
It all blends together. It seems like you guys will go a place like the U.S. I think you're playing there almost every day in November, and then you're out.
We're trying to do the 3 weeks, like I mentioned. That's the goal, more or less, when we tour. And we're doing 3+ weeks, I think, in the U.S. and then stay for a few days just to see the last Slayer show in Los Angeles. That's why we're.
You timed that great.
Yeah, it's perfect. Hey, you want to see Slayer? Yes, we do.
So the album No Comfort is out, and I'm playing it so much, my wife is starting to get a little bit concerned here. But it is a
sorry.
Well, apologize to her. I'm fine with it. That's kind of how my wife does. It's like she'll start off when I get a new record, like, what is this? And then I'll come home 3 weeks later, and she'll be playing it. So that's the cycle that we go through. No Comfort seems to be kind of the next step in the Mono Lord sound. Like, what does this kind of add to the Mono Lord story?
That's a really good question. From the inside, being in the band, this is just a natural development for us. This development has been going on since Rust, the previous album. So for us, it's not that big of a step, obviously, but people from outside the band haven't seen that development because, I mean, we work with music all the time. Mm-hmm. We always bounce ideas back and forth, and we try out new stuff whenever we can. So we have tons of ideas lying around. And when it's time to make an album, we just look at what we have at that given moment and we try to cherry pick a little bit.
Sure.
Find the best parts. And then we pretty much go with the flow of what that collection of songs is. So we let the material guide what we do with it. So we don't sit down beforehand and decide that now we want to take this direction, or now we want to do this, or now we want to make a concept album, which is a question we're getting a lot. We we just simply look at the material we have, and we try to filter out the best parts and go with what that is. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best answer to what No Comfort is. Things are happening.
You're not in the a zoo by chance, are you? I'm hearing a lot of animals there.
Almost. It's a rock club, but yeah. Potato, potato. but I think that's the reason our albums sound like they do. That's diaries of where we are at that given moment. Same thing with No Comfort. It's not a conscious decision. It's just going with the flow, more or less.
Okay. And when it comes to recording, are the songs pretty well baked when you start recording, or are you still piecing them together? And is it a bit more of a jigsaw, or are you thinking that the songs are fully formed?
They're very much fully formed. We do a lot of pre-production, and we do that in our own rehearsal space. So when we hit the studio, where the album is written into the smallest detail and rehearsed into the smallest detail. So very little is written or added in the studio.
Now, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, but No Comfort is the first time you guys have recorded in a studio other than your own.
That's correct.
Okay. And why was that? Like, why the change?
Because the others weren't recorded in a studio. They were recorded in our rehearsal space, which is, it's so small, it's almost laughable. They got to take a lot of pictures of that and post online. It's so small, and we have the hugest backline, so there's no space in there. And every single production we've done up until Rust, we've done there. Mm-hmm. And that has its charm, but we felt like we got to try something else. And something else for us was trying something really traditional, just a regular studio, and inviting another human into the process. That was the biggest part, I think.
Oh, Kim?
Letting someone in. Kim, yes. Which is a good friend of ours. So that's also the reason we trusted him. He's an ace sound technician, and he's a nice guy.
Yeah. Now, for people who may not know who Kim is, Kim Gravander produced this album. This is the first time you guys have also been produced, like you said, working with another person. How was it getting used to that additional person, that maybe that additional person that has equal or even more decision-making power than you've ever had?
We were very particular about not wanting to have a producer, but a co-producer, which is a big difference to us because we've always produced everything by ourselves. So we wanted to co-produce it with Kim. So he made a difference, of course. He made a difference just by being there, just by being one more person, because we've been so used to being in our little tiny bubble, just the three of us in all the creative processes. And don't touch my little thing here that we're building. And then someone else come into that process. So that was challenging as hell. It was crazy. But in a good way, I think, because we had to find new ways to think, new ways to communicate, which I think resonated on the end result. Mm-hmm.
So you've now got this new album recorded in a new environment with another person. You're also on another label. You're now on Relapse. What did that mean for the band?
Meant a lot. It's been four, five great releases with Riding Easy. And both we and Riding Easy, the previous label, felt that we've outgrown their infrastructure a little bit. So Daniel Hall, which is Mr. Riding Easy, actually helped us with getting the Relapse deal, and he continued as our manager. So it was a win-win for us. Mm-hmm. And working with Relapse has been beautiful so far. It's a music loving label. I can't stress that enough. Which is not a given in this business at all. But they're driven by music, and it shows clearly.
It does sound like you're in a zoo, by the way. I don't know what that last thing was. Is that a?
I'm so sorry. This is the most quiet part I could find. I am outside in Cologne, in Germany.
I'm okay.
on some kind.
I'm from Australia. We have all sorts of things, you know.
There you go.
Flying all over the place. So yeah, I don't. I'm fine with that.
That's, I think, just the birds, they disapprove me being here talking.
So yeah, Relapse and Riding Easy, easily two of my favorite record labels, and you guys are on them both. And in fact, I want to make sure people know Relapse.com and WritingEasyRex.com. Both of them have Mono Lord Records right on the front page. You've got some beautiful pressings. Let me ask, what Mono Lord seems to be a band that really is intertwined with vinyl records, and your releases are celebrated with rare, really beautiful pressings, very limited numbers. What role does physical media play in Mono Lord's world domination plan?
The world domination plan.
Yes.
Amazing. Yeah. I think all three of us, we feel strongly that an album is like, and it's a concept, not a concept album, but the entire thing is
it's an
work of art, and
right. Yeah.
It's an experience. And the outside of the physical part of the album is not as important as the music, but very important. So we put a lot of thought into the artwork and the packaging and the colors of the vinyl and all that, because we feel it's important that resonates with the music we put on it.
Yeah, because again, you guys have a lot of energy put into different pressings, different styles. It sounds like you guys even pick the colors that come out, yeah?
Yes and no. Sometimes we get them suggested and we say yes, and sometimes we suggest. So with Relapse, it's been more like they've suggested a range of colors and we said, fine, that looks great. Let's go with it. So on No Comfort, we've put most of the work into the actual packaging of it, or the artwork, the owl on the front, and the how everything should look.
Yeah,
which is important.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's it's all part of, like you say, part of the experience.
Yeah,
the artwork that you have is quite beautiful as well. Does the artwork come after the music, or is it part of the music? Do you know kind of what you want the record to look like as you're making it, or do you look for something afterward?
We look for something afterward. That might sound really weird, but it's been like that on all releases, actually. We've made the music. I think we've even mixed the album, and the album is finalized almost, and then we decide on what to put on the cover. But so this is an existing artwork from years back. I think Mika saw it on an exhibition like 3-4 years back and suggested it, and we all felt like this looks like what we think the album sounds like. Yeah. But we all three of us have our own interpretation of what that is. But we all felt like this looks exactly what we feel like this album is, and that's the way we've been working on all albums. I think Empress Rising is the only one that had artwork created specifically for the album. But after that, it's been existing artwork.
Let's go back a bit here, because I'm very interested to understand musically what got you started. What were the records that you had? I'm assuming they're records. Maybe you grew up in the cassette or CD era, but what was the music that you had as a youth?
I'm 46. I grew up with records, indeed, okay. and radio. But it was a lot of classic rock, and two albums that stood out for me and still stands out for me were Led Zeppelin 2 and the first Black Sabbath album, which my mom had, and was so exciting. It was kind of it was a little bit more evil and a little bit more dark than the rest, and I just loved it.
And your mom brought it.
I mean, yeah. Oh, wow. She had them from when she was young, bought them. And the rest of my parents.
God, all my mom had was polkas. Jesus, I couldn't imagine.
Oh, shit. My condolences.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, my dad had the Johnny Cash, so we kind of had, kind of edged it.
Oh, that's good. That's great.
Yeah, but it's still far away from Black Sabbath. So so you grew up with some very pivotal albums.
Those were the two standing out. Sorry to interrupt, but the rest of it was just like, the rest of it was mostly Bob Dylan, a lot of singer-songwriter stuff, a lot of jazz. So those two albums were actually the only little heavier rock ones. And I think they got it started.
Okay.
Some weird reason.
But yeah. You enjoy jazz quite a bit, yeah? Is that what got you into drums?
No, not really. I enjoy jazz. I'm not listening that much to it. I'm more like it's okay in the background, listener. But what got me into drums, I don't know. I started playing when I was five, I think, and I wanted my own drums. I got my first real rock album from my uncle of mine, which is a Danish band called Gasoline. You know them?
I haven't heard of them. No,
it's super local, but there were superstars in Scandinavia back then, and they released a live album, live in Scandinavia. And I got that. I was just blown away. This was amazing. It was the best thing I've ever heard. And there's a drum solo on that. I was banging away on my pillows. That was my drum kit back then. I was so mad I couldn't play as fast as he could on that drum solo. That was the start of my drumming career.
And you were
getting mad at pillows.
You said you were five or something like that?
Yeah, five-ish, somewhere
wow.
there.
Okay. And it's in Scandinavia. So did your family take you to go see any bands when they saw you having interest?
No, they haven't been much of concert going people, my parents. Mm-hmm. But music loving. So I've been growing up with music. Music's been playing all the time, which I love. I think it's great. It's the best thing, regardless, almost. Even if it's polka. Music. Play music. It's great.
I agree, but polka only goes so far. Just so we're clear on that.
I actually agree a little bit.
It's really good if you're at Oktoberfest, but Sunday morning at 8 a.m., no.
No, I get you.
What is it like being an artist out of Sweden? Now, we hear a lot of stories about that Scandinavian countries tend to value musicians and art on a different scale than they do, say, in the U.S. or the U.K. Is that what you found as well?
There are so many levels to that, but basically, yes. In Sweden, we have something called Studieförbund, which I have no idea how to translate, but it sprung from way back when there was a movement trying to educate the working class, more or less. Mm-hmm. And then it was funded with tax money. So you can start your own circles, it was called, education circles, with whatever subject. And that has, over the years, developed into that you can also have a band as a circle, which means that it's really easy to get a rehearsal space cheap, and you can even get backline cheap. So it's easy to start a band in Sweden. It's easy to have a place to play, and there are lots of money to apply for to do all of this.
It's all funded by taxation and everything, right?
A lot of it has been. That's on the downfall right now because of, all the politics are going to the right, and then the first thing that goes is culture, of course, as always.
There's a reason there's no English word for that. It's because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, probably. But it's great. I mean, we're still having one of those rehearsal spaces that's funded by tax money. So we pay next to nothing to stay in a really nice space. It's small, like I said, but it's great.
And it's like an investment, I would imagine. I mean, and especially with a band like Monolord, you guys have now worked hard enough to be able to reap the rewards, turning it into a business. That's a multiplier. Whoever you pay for coffee or beer, or whatever, that helps the economy. You know, it really isn't any different than funding people to learn how to code or anything like that.
I agree. Absolutely.
All right.
I agree.
Let's start our own country. We've got
exactly. Look at the Netherlands. They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing with that part. They're so great. All the venues or most of them are funded by tax money. They get a lot of money into it. So the venues are beautiful, great sound. Everything is fantastic. A lot of crew, which is well paid and well educated. And you're really welcome. They have their own catering. No matter the size of the venue, it's like the exact opposite of, let's say, the States, where it's a completely different live culture.
You sleep it in your car, and So with all these opportunities in Scandinavia, why is it so associated with really dark heavy metal?
I don't know. Can I think about that one?
You can. You can. I would think they'd be very happy and comfortable. I wouldn't.
Oh, I think that's the answer, actually, now that you say it. I mean, for us, that's the music we play, it's a safety valve. I am so happy after a show, just released all the frustration, all the anger that everyone has. But playing this kind of music is like letting it all out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's that. I have no idea. I don't know why. A lot of metal in Scandinavia. But yeah, it's dark. It's the weather is shit all the time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I always understood why grunge came from Seattle, because, you know, it just seems kind of a little bit down and depressing. All the hair metal and party stuff, party rock came out of L.A. because, you know, all the cocaine. But, I mean, I never understood why Scandinavia always had that black metal coming from it.
No, I just want to mention Scandinavia, speaking of that, and the black metal. I think it's a lot of the black, traditional black metal comes from Norway specifically. Mm-hmm. And in Norway, the old time Christianity is really strong, still is. And geographically in Norway, you have the fjords, the really high mountains, and the which goes down in the fjords, and the, what do you call them in English? The ocean comes in.
Okay.
And the small villages at the end of them, they're really isolated, and they still are, which means that the Christianity, the really dark, old, God-fearing Christianity is still there. And as far as I've understood, the black metal is sprung from that, the frustration from that. Just like the church burning and all that. It's like, fuck this, we can't live like this. This is medieval times, we can't live like this.
Okay.
And I'm not defending murder and church burnings. I'm just
no, that's my job.
I think exactly. but so that's why, as far as I know, black metal is really big in Norway, or has been, and then it's spread because it sounds good. But I don't think the black metal origin in Sweden is that strong. It's stronger in Norway for that reason.
Yeah, because I know Sweden tends to have quite a few heavy metal festivals, which I think is part of the cultural attraction to that part of the world. Now, you mentioned after you get done playing, you feel like you've got all your anger out, you're more relaxed. And after watching you play the drums, you hit those things hard. I mean, it must be completely therapeutic for you to be able to get up and do that, yeah?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's the best thing. Absolutely.
You must break several kits a tour. I don't know how they survive with you. You hit those things hard.
Yeah, I've been doing that since I was a kid, more or less. I mean, I get overexcited, and then I just stopping being overexcited. Just go with the flow. Hey, let's play drums. Let's jump in with both feet. And I still play like that. it's part of the... It's part of the therapy, I guess.
Yeah.
To put it.
Part of the sound, too. I mean, you know, there's three of you.
Yeah,
you got to make a lot of noise for the three of you to fill up, and you do quite well at it. Now, doom and stoner rock seems to be associated very closely with getting high. And I cannot function when I'm high. I'm absolutely horrible. I couldn't make music if I tried. So are you guys pretty baked when you get out on stage, or are you?
Never.
Never?
Okay. Never. No. You wouldn't be able to play any of us, I think. I mean, I usually have one beer with me on stage because it's cozy back there. Mm-hmm. One glass of wine. That's it.
Well, you're sweating it out, too.
Oh, yes, I am. No, I know that's more of a image thing than it's reality. I mean, of course, people smoke, but no, we wouldn't be able to play if we were baked. It would sound horrible.
I know. I just want to eat a bag of Doritos and go to sleep. I can't imagine getting up on this stage. And geez. So talk to me about the merch booth, because you guys do a lot of special vinyl specifically for your tour. And you guys have tons of shirts and that sort of thing. What role does vinyl records play in the merchandising and really the business, the modern business of a band?
For us in this genre, it plays a huge role. It's part of the whole thing. I think a band like us is expected to have vinyls the way we have vinyls or LPs. in different colors, different variations and limited editions and such. And I kind of like that. And I, most of the people that buy stuff, they want to have their physical LP and they want to have their t-shirt with them when they leave. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it plays a big part. It does play a big part.
Yeah. To me, it would seem in a band, vinyl would be the perfect item to be able to sell. You don't have to have small, medium, and large, and it's nice and big. It kind of sells itself. It doesn't. You don't need to have a sign like you have pointing to a CD. Look at this little thing. This is $20 or whatever. The only downside is it's heavy. But you guys are big blokes. You can carry a few boxes.
And we're old. getting tired. But yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's its own sign. You just put it there. And I work the same way. When I go see a band and I see a beautiful LP, it's like, I want to have this. I want to buy this.
Yeah.
I never have the money, though, but I want to buy it. But the weird thing is we still sell CDs. I thought CDs was a dead medium. When we get to the US specifically, we sell a lot of CDs. Still out there.
Does it surprise you that some of the records that you make, some of the special pressings, go for several hundred dollars sometimes?
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
So that surprises me. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I'm giving you the news. Yeah. Some of the early pressings of things, let's say Empress Rising, the first pressing was, you know, there was like 50 clear versions. Veneer, there was 35 or 75 of this one, or a certain splatter one. And on the secondary market, those go for sometimes over $100.
Wow. That's a huge compliment. Makes me happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice. I didn't know it.
There are people out there that are collecting all variations of Monolords. I mean, people who probably have 20 copies of Rust just so they could have all the different vinyl variations.
Yeah. I've seen posters that sometimes it's like, that's amazing, dude. It's crazy, but it's amazing. It's wild. It's hard to grasp, but it's, yeah. Hey, makes me happy, of course.
Yeah, well, you're making a lot of people happy with it, and a lot of people with OCD are building these big Monolord collections. Do you have you ever had to buy your own record?
No, our personal copies, no.
Okay, the record.
What do you mean?
Oh, like if you said, "Oh, I want that splatter. I can't get it anywhere. I'm just going to go ahead."
No, we always get one each of everything that's printed. So no, we don't have to buy that.
Oh wow, okay.
That would suck.
Yeah,
having to buy your own stuff.
You would owe yourself royalties.
Yeah, exactly.
There's one EP that's particularly collectible. Again, this, I don't know if this is new news to you or not. There's the Fairies Wear Boots EP. There's a 10-inch lathe version. Apparently,
there were
50 units made. What's the story on that? You recall?
Yes, the story was that Daniel at the Riding Easy he told us about this lathe technique of printing, or it's not printing even, it's like the needle straight into the material, I think. But never mind. He thought about let's make a few copies of this with the Black Sabbath cover on it, just because it would be fun to try out, and we felt the same. And that was pretty much the story about it. Just make something half weird, mm-hmm. old time format that still works, but it's kind of weird. So that was the story. Let's make something fun.
So in the first press, you're absolutely right. It's a lathe. It's a hand. It's like a handmade product. It's etched. Each one is etched specifically. And there were to be 50 units made. However, 20 of them apparently were busted. And I think 20 more were lost in transit by the band. That's the story, anyway. Do you recall any of that?
It wasn't lost by us. I think it was half that was lost by USPS. Thank you. that was weird. That was a really weird process. It ended up with us talking to them and asking them, "Hey, what's happening with this package?" And then they said that, "We don't know, we can't find it, and also we don't give a fuck." So it was just gone. So somewhere out there, there is a box.
There's a rich postman.
Yeah, exactly. So we still haven't gotten that box bag. It's amazing.
Okay. Well, that made him even more rare. So apparently, the story continues, 20 further replacement copies were distributed to fans in Europe via a lottery held through Instagram.
Yes, that's right, I think. Yeah. That's way back.
I'm going back. Yes.
Yeah.
This is the sort of detail record nerds love. So that's why I'm just trying to extract any more tidbits of the story here.
No, I don't remember. A lot of things happened around that release. I don't remember anything more than that box being missed, and it was like, this is so strange. This is really, and we really decided to we will not make any more of these. But yeah. Well, what can you do? USPS, amazing.
So yeah, be on the lookout out there for a postman that's buying everyone drinks in the pub.
exactly. Yes.
I understand, Espen, that you're also starting to produce bands. You recently produced an album from a band, Cities of Mars. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I've been producing everything they've released, actually. A few EPs and this full length.
This is out of your studio, right? This is your recording?
No, I actually don't have a studio. Many people think I have a studio, but I made the decision way back that since having a studio in Sweden is super hard because it's expensive. The prices on everything in Scandinavia is pretty high compared to the rest of Europe. Mm-hmm. So having a studio there means you have to record a lot of music that you probably won't like at all. And I've seen so many studio owners in Sweden sitting there like 5 or 10 years in, just hating music and hating their job. And I decided that I don't want to risk that. I don't want to end up hating music. That would be the absolute worst thing that could happen. So I decided to, I buy just the most basic recording kit I can have to make a decent recording, but yeah, portable, good, portable studio, more or less. Mm-hmm. And then I just focus on basic day jobs to pay my bills and then produce bands that I feel I can contribute something to. So that's why I don't produce that many bands, basically. Because it's a really producing is just as hard money wise as is to making money off playing in a band. So it's
now, is Mono Lord just about at that point for you to where that's your full-time gig?
It's a full-time gig time-wise, but not money-wise.
Right.
As it is for many bands, I guess. But
and podcasts, by the way.
Yeah. I feel you. We're getting there. Absolutely. It's going well. People are super supportive. We have the best fans. They buy a lot of merch. Buy a lot of LPs, so we're getting there, absolutely, and we tour a lot. So
I got to tell you, Espen, it is an absolute pleasure watching your band go from strength to strength. I mean, the first couple albums, we were into them. Rust came out, that was a heavy hitter. No Comfort, this whole other level. It's like, you know, we're really cheering you on. We're really behind your band. And I tell you, I'm in Australia, so I'm looking forward to the next time you guys are touring down here. But everyone who's in Europe, who's in the U.S., go over to, I believe it's facebook.com/MonolordSweden or monolordstore.com. Check out the tour dates. Go see this band. And bring cash for the merch table because all the records are there. You got special pressings that are just for tours. You got t-shirts that the designs are awesome. Mono Lord is a band that we just really enjoy getting behind. And so we're so glad to see you guys go from strength to strength and just keep going to that next level. It's an absolute pleasure to watch.
That gives me goosebumps. That means a lot. It does. Thank you so much.
All right, there you have it, Espen Willems of the awesome band Mono Lord. You got to check them out on their tour, folks. Facebook.com/MonolordSweden. Also pick up their music at monolord.bandcamp.com and writingeasyrex.com. Make sure to support this band. They are really friggin' awesome. You're going to have a great time when you see them live. I guarantee it.
Alrighty, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Again, make sure to check out The Vinyl Guide Live podcast. Coming up November 9th, Australian Music Week. Going to be interviewing Bob Lefsetz in front of a group of weirdos. And also Saturday, November 23rd, Cream Tangerine in Costa Mesa, California with Zappa Vault Meister Joe Travers. Again, all information is up at facebook.com/vinylguide. We hope to see you soon. I'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.